Any questions so far about that?
Yeah.
What does take dependence mean?
Take dependence means that you are depending on the preceptor to train you. So you stay near the person who ordained you, and then they train you, and you serve them. So it's a very much of a thing that the disciple serves and takes care of the teacher, you know, in chores and errands and personal things and cleaning and stuff like that. And then the teacher takes care of the student by teaching the Dharma and then making sure that they have the food, clothing, and so on. So it's a dependent relationship. And if your preceptor, if you can't take dependence on your preceptor, then they usually send you somewhere else where there's a resident lama, a resident teacher, and then you live and train under the guidance of that teacher. But it's very clear in Vinaya that you don't ordain and then go live on your own. And this is the tragedy, really, of what happens to so many Westerners who ordain. Is they ordain and they go live on their own, and you know, and it's so difficult for them. You know, really difficult. Fred?
You said that there are the eight and then there are the ten, there are five precepts and the three follow precepts or wear robes.
Uh-huh.
They're don't wear lame clothes. Those are part of the novice? Does the novice eight and the novice ten, or did I get confused?
No. There's the Rabdra, which has the five lay precepts plus those three. Okay. Then there's the Anagarika, in which you have the eight precepts, which are different, you know, not the same as the five and the three. The five are the same, but not the other three. Then you have the ten precepts. And with the ten, what's happened is the singing, dancing, playing music, and the perfumes, garlands, and ornaments have been broken into two vows, and then the one about not handling money is added. So that makes the ten.
Okay. And those are three different levels of knowledge?
No, the Anagarika is you're still a layperson.
Mm-hmm.
The Rabdrung, you're kind of in this in-between stage. It's you've renounced, but you're not really a novice. So you haven't taken the ten precepts. Ten precepts mark you as a novice. Okay? Yeah?
Now, my question really is more in the monastic gatherings and stuff, is this issue about taking dependence and the fact that there isn't such a thing very much in the Western Tibetan Sangha? Is that discussed? Is there some concern about how that.
Okay. So in our monastic gatherings, there's this thing about the situation in the Western Sangha in the Tibetan tradition discussed. Yes, it is. And, you know, it's one of these things. First of all, not all the Westerners in the Tibetan tradition go to these meetings, which is a real pity because a lot of them, and you see this, are very centered around their own teacher and their own group. And they don't leave their own teacher and their own group to go to these intermonastic things or you know, other things like that. So those people, you know, they follow their teachers, and if their teachers do it that way, that's the way they do it. You know, it's very clear when you go to these monastic gatherings, you know, the people who've been trained and the people who haven't been trained. Wouldn't you say that? It's very clear. And so sometimes you get in these gatherings some, you know, young people who have been, or middle-aged people who have been ordained in the Tibetan tradition. They're not really being trained. They may be living on their own or whatever, and they come to these gatherings and it's really kind of a surprise for them. And of course they're talking about their situation, living in the city, you know, working at a job or doing this or that or the other thing. And, you know, and everybody else from the other tradition sees it, they know about it. But the thing is that the ordination procedure is in the hands of the Tibetans. And I know in the FPMT they've been trying to set up some regulations and get it so that the Western Sangha interviews people and okays them and screens them for ordination. But that hasn't worked so well because the lamas feel like this is their choice and they will override things. And their feeling is that it's better to keep vows in this degenerate age for one day than your whole lifetime at the time of the Buddha. And so they're very open and receptive to ordaining just about everybody. And like I said before, they don't screen the people very well. So people with debt, you know, get ordained. People who have psychological problems are ordained. People who have no way of supporting themselves afterwards get ordained. But it's very difficult as a Westerner to kind of try and do anything about it because that they see that as their ballpark. In recent years, there's been one Western nun, Venerable Jyotika, and she's been working with His Holiness's translator. And His Holiness's office has now started having people fill out an interview form and really making sure that people know what they're getting into, that they have a place to live afterwards and so on. So it's much improved from the way it was years ago. She would like to make it even stricter, and I agree with her, to tell you the truth. But the Tibetans just, because in their monasteries, in old Tibet, a quarter of the population was ordained. They just want to ordain everybody because their philosophy is you ordain everybody, and out of that you get a few really qualified, excellent practitioners, and then the other people, they benefit from living in the monastery, and if they disrobe, it's okay, at least they've had that benefit. Or they stay in the monastery and they become the worker monks. So that's kind of the Tibetan philosophy. But for the West, I don't think that philosophy works so well. I mean, in Tibet you needed a lot of monks because if you're doing the debating studies, then you need a lot of different people to debate with. Okay? But in the West, we're just trying to start the Sangha. And so we need people who are going to be trained, and we need teachers who are going to train them, and we need to screen the people well to get the Sangha community up and going so that the community has some solidity and stability to it, because if the community doesn't have that, then, all my experience in France is, all it took is one person with some problems and the whole community goes out of shape, And especially if nobody's willing to listen to the senior who's there because they say, I'm only listening to my teacher. And so their teacher isn't living there, their teacher's living somewhere else and sent them to live there. But then they don't necessarily want to listen to the resident teacher, or they don't want to listen to the senior monk or nun. They all only listen to my teacher, and it gets pretty complicated. Yeah? So, yeah. So, there's very different views on this. Like I said, now His Holiness's office is becoming more strict, and I think it's very good. Because they've started having this pre-ordination program at Tushita, that now people who ordain with His Holiness, they have to go to that. The program just started a few years ago. For many years, there was no such thing. People just showed up, they got ordained, and they walked out, and they said, now what do I do? Some of them had teachers, some of them didn't, some of them had money to live on, some of them didn't. So now it's, for the Westerners anyway, it's getting a little bit more organized. But the Tibetans, they ordain and they go right into a monastery somewhere. So they have room and board and whatever. It may not be great room and board, but it's something, and they have a community and they are cared for, And they already know something about the Dharma and they know what to expect. Whereas I heard that, a few years ago there was one man who came to the pre-ordination course, a Western man, and he didn't even know that you had to be celibate. It was like he had, seen, oh, Buddhist monks and nuns, gee, I want to be one, and didn't even know that. So sometimes people have a lot of fanciful thinking, and and then they aren't screened well, and it becomes very difficult, and then you see the rest of society doesn't respect the monastics, you know, and if the monastics aren't trained well, why should they? But then if they aren't respected, then they don't have the confidence or the willingness to, you know, or the inspiration to do the training. Yeah. So it's very hard. I mean, like when I lived in France, I think I told you, you know, the nuns were chopping the vegetables, working in the lay people's kitchen, cleaning the lay people's bathroom. You know, then we led pujas, you know, that was our nunly thing to do, and then some of us were asked to teach, but, you know, it wasn't a situation where the Sangha was respected, and, you know, we were all brand new. There was, you know, the senior person had been ordained maybe 8 years. That was it. Yeah. So it was hard. Yeah, it was hard. And then we were living in this nunnery. We all had to pay to live there. How are you supposed to get money to pay? So, you had a question.
I was just wondering if there was like an equivalent to Rabjung in any of the other Vinaya traditions.
There's an equivalent to Rabjung in the other Vinaya traditions. I haven't heard of one. There might be, but or it could be that they just give the full 10 precepts, or they give the 5 precepts with celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's that in Rabjung and the others. I haven't heard.
Considering the state of when you first were ordained, how did you learn with an eye? How did you train?
Okay, so how did, consider the state of everything. When I ordained, how did I learn the Vinaya and how did I train? It was miraculous. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we had teachings on the Vinaya. I had asked before I ordained, usually, you know, they won't let you study the Vinaya and know the precepts before you ordained, but I used to hang out with the nuns because I wanted to be a nun. And so when they were receiving teachings on the novice vows by Dishinalandarge, I asked his permission to be able to attend. And he very kindly said yes. And so I was able to have the teachings on that before I received the vows. The other nuns, you know, after you get ordained, then you should request teachings on the vow, on the precepts. You know. Now, of course, some people didn't even know that they were supposed to request teachings. I mean, when you're brand new, what do you know? And when you weren't even born as a Buddhist or brought up as a Buddhist, you don't know what to do. Yeah. But Lama Yeshe, you know, was very kind, and so he arranged from time to time. There were different teachings on the Vinaya. So we learned those things. Some of it, you know, went through translation, so sometimes it was hard to understand, because in those days the translators didn't have all the terms, you know, well thought out yet. And so then, you know, when I ordained, we were living in Copan. Lama really wanted us to live in community. He was big on community. And so he had the Western Sangha living together as community, doing practice together there every morning and evening, and having teachings together. And so just that process of living together was a kind of training, because you had to follow a schedule and you couldn't do your own trip, and everybody had their different jobs and responsibilities in the Sangha, and we had to take the responsibility, whatever our job was. You know, some people were in charge of different things, the kitchen or the this or the that, and everybody had to do their job, or else clearly the rest of the community was not very happy. So, you know, so that was, you know, a way of training when in living together. And then I lived some time at the library there. I was living on my own, so I didn't have the benefit of training with the community. But Geshe Nalandarge trained us very well. If we did anything wrong, he usually told us. Yeah. And then when I lived in France, you know, we trained there, living as a community. But then, like I said, the person who was oldest ordained when we started that was ordained 8 years, yeah, which was not very long. And you know, and the nuns were in an interesting situation because we lived in the horse stables that were attached to the chateau, because the Dharma Center was in this old French chateau. So the lay people lived in the chateau, and the nuns lived in the horse stables. And then the monks lived 11 kilometers away in a house that was initially purchased where the nuns were supposed to live, but somehow the monks wound up getting it. And so there was a geshe at the center, and there was a geshe at Nalanda Monastery. And so we used to study with both of them, but we didn't have our own senior living with us. Yeah, who was also a nun who could guide, you know, and we didn't. And at that time, you know, the Westerners didn't respect the senior, you know, our own seniors very much, you know, because we had never been trained to do that. Yeah, I mean, all these things need people to tell you. Yeah, and at the very beginning, you know, we were just kind of trying to get a community started and do whatever we could to, you know, start things. Yeah, I mean, we moved in the horse stables and converted it into a nunnery. Yeah, so, yeah?
I was just wondering, I've heard, you know, on certain occasions that some of the senior monastics don't have much of anything to guide them, everyone. And I'm wondering why that happens, and also, like, is there any skillful way for a junior to, like, encourage the seniors to become more involved?
Okay. So you've heard sometimes, and I presume you're talking about the Westerners here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that the Western seniors don't have much inkling to train the juniors. And is there any way that the juniors can encourage them to do that? Well, having been kind of among the first, or, you know, ones ordained in the first few years, I know that when I try to say something to juniors, there are, you know, some people, they just, you know, you aren't my teacher. Yeah? What do you know? Or, you know, they just did not want to listen. There was this feeling, if I only listen to my teacher, you're a Westerner like me, you don't know anything, and we're all equal. And, you know, so when you get that kind of reaction, then you just start keeping your mouth shut. Yeah? So, like, even this summer, when I was staying at one place, I was living with people who were junior to me, but they were not my students, and I did not have any kind of a title as, you know, being the senior in the household. We were just all renting rooms in the same house. So, you know, and the house belonged to the monastery. So in that situation, I, you know, didn't give any feedback to anybody. There was one woman there who was my student. So when I saw things, I tried to give her some guidance and things like that, because she was my student. Yeah. But with the other ones who weren't, then, you know, I just am very reluctant to say anything unless they come to me. You know, at one point there was one nun who wanted to talk some things over with me, and she came to me and asked me for guidance, and then I gave some. But, you know, the thing of just how people are living together, somebody who's, even if they're junior, if I'm not in that role or I'm not the teacher, I'm not going to say anything, because I've just been in too many situations with Westerners where they, you know, don't want it. Yeah? So that's why I feel that this thing of, you know, taking dependence is important, because then that role is very clear, you know. You've decided that you're going to depend on that person, you know, and you're going to serve them and take care of them, and then they're going to, you know, kind of guide you, and they're going to point things out on the day-to-day level. Yeah? And so that establishes that kind of relationship so that that can happen. How can the juniors encourage the seniors? I think by going specifically, you know, if there's one senior that you see that behaves very well, that, you know, is inspiring to you and you want to become like that person, then you go to them and you say, please, you know, if you see me doing anything wrong, you know, or improper etiquette or whatever, please point it out to me. And then when they do, then you really listen and take it to heart. Yeah? Because this is actually one of the qualities that's very important for being a monastic, is the ability to take feedback, the ability to receive feedback. And it's very interesting in our precepts. I don't know how it is for the monks' precepts, but in the nuns' precepts, in the second class, you know, there was the first class was the ones that if you break them from the root, you're gone. The second class, they're called remainders, because if you break them completely, then you have a remainder of your vow, but, you know, you're in danger. A lot of those have to do with not taking admonition. So there's certain kind of actions that the Buddha said you shouldn't do, and some of them you're given one warning, and if you don't change the next time you do it, then, you know, you have this procedure that you have to do. Others of them you get three warnings, and if you don't, then there's, you know, that what is called manatta, this other thing you have to do. And so a lot of it has to do with the ability to receive admonition, you know. Admonition just being, you know, advice from seniors who are not being authoritarian, who are not doing power trips or anything, but who, you know, kind of know the etiquette, know the behavior, know the precepts, and are trying to guide you in a way, or point things out. Yeah, and you just say, you know, or like, you know, the Sangha is so biased and partial, so-and-so gets to do this, but when it comes to me, you won't let me do it. Yeah, so, you know, you receive some feedback about your behavior, and you don't like it, and so then you accuse the Sangha of being partial and biased and things like that. So that's not so good to do. Yeah, but, you know, you could, I mean, look how we are. How are we when people give us feedback that we don't like? Yeah, we're reactive, aren't we? Do we ever put our palms in front and say, thank you very much for pointing that out to me? We don't say that. We say, who are you to tell me that? And I disagree, and so-and-so told me I can do it, and I think this is the best thing to do. And I want to do this because of this reason, blah, blah, blah. You know? So that kind of attitude on our part makes monastic life difficult for us sometimes, you know, because people are going to give us feedback, and you know, we're so touchy, tiny things make us so unhappy, you know. It's like, you know, some of you may have noticed with the Venerable Tarpa, I've been showing her what to do with her skirt in the last, you know, the shundap, I lower rope the last few days. She's very good, and she takes it, and she wants to do it. But some people I could say the same thing to, and they would go, why? This is such a small thing. Why are you doing this? And, you know, yours doesn't look any better, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know? And it becomes quite difficult, doesn't it? Yeah?
Is it just as Westerners? Isn't it more like in all of the Asian traditions that any seniors would be respected by seniors and guided and followed?
Yeah. In all of the traditions, you know, the seniors are respected, and the seniors have responsibility to guide. Mm-hmm. So when we talk of juniors and seniors, because we've been raised in the West, our instant thing about democracy and our dislike of hierarchy comes out. Mm-hmm. You know? But then, you know, human beings always have hierarchy. If we don't have hierarchy, how are we going to learn from those who know more than us? You know? And to tell you the truth, I don't want to be equal to my teachers. If I'm equal to my teachers, you know, then things are really bad. Yeah? And so I think it's quite good for all of us, for our training, to be able to show respect to those who have been ordained longer. Sometimes people who have been ordained longer, some of them have good behavior, some of them don't. Okay? But you still respect them for the years they've kept the vows. You don't model your behavior on their bad behavior. But everybody has some good behavior, so you can still model yourself on their good behavior. Doesn't mean that if somebody's senior, you copy everything they do.
I was just thinking that in the West, Fonda really isn't supported, like the way people don't support financial or with respect, or even I was thinking sort of in my own experience, having a relationship between like Western Fonda and those people, and monastics aren't really in a position, what can monastics and lay people also do to sort of collect this
lack of relationship? Okay, so you're seeing that there's a lack of a strong and a good relationship between the lay people and the Sangha, and what can be done to correct that. I think there needs to be a lot of education. The education is difficult, you know, because, for example, if I'm sitting here telling you to respect seniors and I'm the senior, then there's a high likelihood that all of you are going to think, well, she's just saying that because she's senior and she's on an ego trip and wants to be respected. That's how we think, isn't it? Yeah. And so it becomes hard sometimes as the teacher or as the senior to talk about respecting the teacher or respecting the senior, because when people just say you're on an ego trip. So a lot of times that depends on the senior students actually to set the example for it and to educate the newcomers, to show them, you know, how to offer respect, what cases you offer respect, you know, and different things like that. Okay? And then to also make it so that respect is, there's a big difference between respect and fear. Okay? And often in our Western mind, it's that difference is not clear. We assume that as soon as we respect somebody, we've got to be afraid of them, because they have power over us. And that's not what this is about in a Sangha. You know, because in the Sangha, the seniors have responsibility towards the juniors to guide them and train them and educate them and be good examples. You know, your responsibility is not to be on a power trip. Okay? So if somebody's on a power trip, then, you know, hopefully the other seniors will point that out to that person. Yeah, that needs to happen. But, you know, we get things very confused with the whole issue of respect. And then we don't know how to show respect. And so sometimes we show certain kind of respect in situations where you don't do it. I was talking to one of my old Dharma friends. She's a translator for one of our teachers now. But, you know, we both came to Dharamsala about the same time, and she was telling me how one day she met Dishanalandarge in the road, you know, coming or going back from the market or something. And, you know, you're supposed to bow when you see your teacher, so she bowed right there in the middle of the road. And it's like, well, actually, that isn't the situation where you show that kind of respect, you know. Like before teachings, you bow. If you go in for a private interview or something like that, you bow. But not in the middle of the road. Yeah. And so there's, you know, just to learn, when to show respect, how to show respect. And then to really see that respect is not something that's being demanded of you. It can never be demanded. But we show respect because respect is good for our own mind, because it opens us to receive the benefits of learning from that person. Yeah? And respect reduces our arrogance and makes us more receptive. Okay? So again, you know, so you show respect in different situations. Now, does that mean that everything somebody tells you to do, you just, you know, you're in the army and you go, yes, sir, and, you know, do it? No, it doesn't mean that. You know, you still think for yourself. If you don't understand an instruction, you know, and I assume it's this way in the military too, you ask questions, because if you don't understand, how are you going to do it? Yeah? So you ask questions. If you have some expertise in that area, you give some feedback, you know, so it isn't like, you know, you're waiting for one person to go, and, you know, you don't move until somebody gives you the order of what to do. No, you have to be in whatever area you have in the monastery. That is your responsibility, and you take that responsibility and you move the ball forward with it, and you're reliable in the work you do. But when you receive feedback, you try and listen to the feedback without having that knee-jerk reaction of, you know, who are you? Yeah? Which is our knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? So, you know, we learn to work with it, and everybody learns to work with it. Yeah? But it's a thing of making ourselves open, you know. And here we're talking specifically about how to keep the precepts and how to keep the etiquette, you know. So that's one level of training. Now, whether we make the circumambulation path 6 inches, 2 feet wide or 2.5 feet wide, you know, that's the kind of thing where there's room for discussion in what you're doing. You know, because that's not regarding the precepts, it's not regarding the monastic etiquette, it's regarding the practical work that needs to be done. Okay? Is something coming from that? Yeah? But I think, you know, it's nice if the senior students kind of take on some of this role of educating the new people who come in. And my experience has been that the new people, when they first come in, actually, because I remember Carl, when you came in, you were saying, tell me what to do, I don't know. So you know, when you first come in, you really want somebody to tell you what to do, because, you know, and you need that help. And so I think that the senior lay people often in Asia help the newcomers to the temple in that way. Yeah? Okay, let's sit quietly.